This is me. I would like to look at creative wise compassion. And first to look a little at how in the various Buddhist traditions there have been certain emphasis on compassion. For example, in the Zen tradition, there is a series of four vows that whenever there is any ceremony, we recite those vows. And the first vow is sentient being and mandala. I vow to serve them all. Of course, in a way, one has to be a little careful here. And one must not take this literally, that every day, how many have I saved? 5.5. Not good today, But more as a kind of early opening of the heart to every living being we encounter. And also for me, that being saved can be a little problematic. And sometimes we want to save people against our wishes. And personally, I would think more about I vow to serve them more. I think this would be more, in a way, adequate to really the feeling, which is shown that we must be concerned for all sentient beings. And also in the Korean Zen tradition, especially you find a series of precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts, which are 58 precepts, which I translated. And which the base of the precepts is not so much, it's not really rules and regulations, but it's very much from the point of view of compassion. Again and again it will say, you do this because of a compassionate mind. If you do this, you will kill compassion. So again and again the basis very much is compassion. And what is interesting with this precept is that it's not seen as an end in themselves, as rule and regulation, but that every year you take them as a renewal of your commitment, or as a renewal to consider this as important. And the monks and the nuns, they recite them actually once a month. So again, as a renewal of what is important, what is the basis of their life, wisdom and compassion. And the reason I translated with the precept was that over time I could understand them. And I realized that they really created the atmosphere in the temple. That a lot of the things people were doing, my teacher was doing, was because they had really integrated these precepts. And one of the precepts is, if someone comes to ask for forgiveness, do not rebuke them, but really take it very compassionately. And this created over time in Korea a system which I find very fascinating, because it's a system of forgiveness where if you make a mistake, you just have to go to somebody a little higher up, you bow 3 times, and you say, I made a mistake. And this is it. This is where this is finished. You just have to do this, nothing else. And it will never be mentioned ever again. And to me it was very foreign, because I thought, what can you do? Don't go there! How can you really definitely forgive them? Because it seems to me that in the West, or in the modern world, what we do is that we forgive, but we don't forget. So that, we'll bring it up later on. But these are not at all really, I say it. It's really it. That's all you have to do. And the problem with the Westerners is that, when Master Kiran would say, you made a mistake, the Westerner would say, and they would go into true story of, explaining why. And Master Kiran would look at him like, why is that so complicated? You could just bow 3 times, say, I made a mistake, and you'd be finished. And go to it. But no, we have to make it very complicated. And to me, I was very touched by that. This really following that precept to really properly, accept and forgive. And I had this beautiful moment with my sister when we were traveling in America, and somebody asked him, in a way a relatively silly question in some ways. So, you know, what do you think? Should I go and practice in a Catholic monastery or in a Zen monastery? So, of course, Master Kuzen was a little dogmatic. And I kind of questioned. I said, but why can't you go into a, you know, Catholic monastery, da 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 da. So we kind of got into a little kind of a discussion there. And then we kind of had to stop. And then I felt bad because I kind of felt it arguing with my teacher. I mean, you don't do this, you know. So I said, okay. So I went to him, you know, and I bowed three times and I said, I made a mistake. And then he looked at me and said, I made one too. And this was it. It was the start. It was a very special moment. In the Tibetan tradition, also there too, the compassion is very important. There is one of the very interesting practices is this exchange of self for others. That there is this practice where you really try to really put yourself in the other person's shoes, but like constantly, constantly. So you see them as yourself, and you see them as yourself. I mean, it's kind of really, and it's quite complicated, and when you read about it, you get very confused, because you have to put I for you, and you for I, and, but it's very much this idea of again opening to the other, of seeing the other, and of opening our heart to the other. And of course, in the Theravada Vipassana tradition, we find the metta and the karuna meditation, which is about loving kindness, which is about compassion, which I will introduce tomorrow. But I think with metta and karuna, when we say, may you be happy, may you be at peace, may you be free from suffering, may I be happy, may I be at peace, may I be free from suffering, I think we have to be very careful. Although the wording sounds like a wish or a prayer, the practice itself is not. So it's not a prayer. It's not a prayer at distance. It is a way to incline the mind into a certain direction. I think it is very important to see that. It's a way to cultivate, to incline the mind, to remind ourselves of loving kindness, to remind ourselves of compassion. And if we look at the Buddha himself, what was very interesting in his time is that one of the first things he did was to, a lot of the time he transformed comfort, he transformed practice, and he transformed the practice of sacrifice. Because in his day, they were sacrificing, and to this day, some still do that in India, to kill animals for special religious practices and things like that. And he said, no, if you want to sacrifice anything, then you have to sacrifice butter, you have to sacrifice candle, you have to sacrifice infant. So what you have to offer will not cause suffering to any sentient being. And that's why, and in a way, in Buddhism it's even turned, even though positively, because not only were you not supposed to kill animals, you were also supposed, in a way, over time, but developed to rescue them. So in China, for example, you have a practice that the lay people do, which is to go to the market and to buy live animals and then to release them. The only problem is that the market people go and get them back and sell them again. But so these poor sentient beings get kind of amused quite a bit about. But it got so that, in a way, in the 19th century, people would bring their old animals to the Chinese temple, and then they would live out their retirement. The cow, the snake, the donkey, I mean, it was like a kind of a zoo in some of these monasteries. There was all these old animals that they would take care of. So really kind of, in a way, not only in a way wishing it, but in practical terms, very much doing it. So I would say, in a way, one of the aspects of the meditation, as I mentioned before, is really to open the heart. And really, I feel that time to time as we sit, we can experience it, this opening of the heart, because in a way, everything that tightens our heart, that closes it up, is dissolved. So then we can really open to ourselves, to others, to the world. And so at one level I would say compassion is this innate feeling. I think generally in most people there are this innate feeling of compassion, which is an innate feeling of responding to suffering. That if somebody suffers, someone suffers from human, from sentient beings suffer, then we feel for that being. Because we know the suffering is painful, the suffering is lonely, so we feel for that suffering, because we too have experienced suffering. And, you know, one doesn't need to be religious to have that inner feeling. And I remember from years back, I was just moved in this little village in France, and I'm on the first floor, and one day I kept seeing all these people going to the neighbor's house. An old lady who lived on her own, my mother went, everybody went, you know, they kind of seemed to take turns to go there. And so finally I asked my mother about what's going on. And she said, oh, the old lady, she just got a cancer and now she's cured and she just come back home and she's very weak. So many people in the village have got together to just regularly take care of her. But I just didn't do it for a day. They did it for 2 weeks. And this was, they were not specially Christian or anything, they were just people in the village, caring for other people in the village. And so there was an innate feeling of compassion for someone who suffers, that caring, that concern. So in a way, that ability to feel, to empathize, to respond, and to connect. But in a way also to see, I think that with compassion, especially in terms of, you know, Buddhism and meditation, to see that we can have very different compassion, and that we, in a way, need to work on what I would call creative wise compassion, which is a skillful and creative response. But I think it is, in a way, hopefully relatively easy for most people to have the feeling. But from that inner feeling, what do we do? Is there a creative wise response for the other? So in a way, it's not just a feeling, compassion, but it's an action, it's a movement, it's an activity, it's not just, but I think it's relatively, in some way, easy to feel the compassion. But at the same time, can there be an active, a creative response? And to me, one of the stories which has really moved me at that level is the story of Christopher Nolan. I don't know if you've ever read this book, Under the Eye of the Clock. And it's a young Irish man who was born very disabled. He was very disabled in many different ways. But when he was born, his parents did not see him as a disabled child. They saw him just as their child, with a potential like any other human being. So they did everything so that the potential of that child could flower. And because of that, then he became, he wrote books, and he's a great poet, and he's amazing, he's an amazing person. But if it had not been cultivated and flowered and been in bloom, then nothing of very little could have come out. So in a way, I feel this is, in a way, each of us, our responsibility to not fix people, but in the creative wise compassion to open to people in their condition and in a way to look beyond their condition and to really reach out to them. And so at that level I would say in compassion there is also availability. Because if you don't have the feeling, does it mean you're not going to be compassionate? This is a question. To me, it does depend on having a certain feeling. And by this I was inspired by Gabriel Marcel, who is a French existential philosopher. And he said one of the important things in compassion and love is availability. Because you see, you have a friend, he said, with an ear. And then you feel for that person because you see the suffering, it's very clear. And if I only a few days I go to a hospital to visit you, and in 3 days you don't feel like it. But you go to see that friend because you're available to their suffering. It doesn't just depend on the feeling it arrives upon the contact. But also, I feel that the compassion is something we have to be careful not to see. Often we see compassion as this very heroic movement of wanting, you know, to save the world, wanting to do this heroic gesture. But one other thing which really showed me what compassion was, once I was living in Bordeaux, in France, in the countryside, and so we kind of go and watch film, special kind of artistic film, and so we have this kind of, they tell us what they're going to do. And then once I saw this, I look them all carefully to see if they're interesting, and then once was about the reforming of the self. I thought, oh, I want to see that. You know, anything to do with self and reforming of the self, I want to see. So off I go with Steve. I said, let's go to see this. And we were three in the auditorium, us two and one person. And the film was actually very intense, especially very intense at the beginning to see. Because that, the reforming of the self was about people who had accidents which damaged their health. And then they, you know, they lose their ability, they lose nearly their personality. And so the documentaries are just followed for 3 years, a kind of a series of people to see how they redefine themselves in some way. And in fact, what touched me was not so much the reforming of the self of these various people and how it happened, but the compassion of the people who worked in that unit. It was kind of a special hospital unit. And the compassion, because every day the challenge was so minute. And every day, for a year, for 2 years, we do the same minute movement, so it's a little more. And the kindness they had, the patience they had, to me, that was really compassion. It was not something heroic, it was a fact that every day, even if you were tired, if you had problems in your family, whatever happened in your life, every day, that person was there for the minute change to help that other person. That, I think, is compassion. This is the kind of the most beautiful compassion. It is, in a way, very ordinary, but to me, actually, that is heroic compassion. So, in a way, in compassion, I would see the recognition of life, the recognition of the other. So, in a way, a move, as I was mentioning the other day, from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. But in compassion, I think we have to be careful. This is not about us disappearing in the act of compassion. I think we have to be very present. And also, you know, having as much compassion for ourselves as for others. And again, wisdom arising within that. But what is also interesting to look at is that there can be many different compassion. And I think this is something as Lady Thatcher we can look at. Because I think most of the time, I would say most Buddhist meditators are ready to be compassionate. I think often we feel it's our duty to be compassionate as Buddhist self-meditator. And what is interesting is to look at the different types of compassion that we experience, that we show in our lives. And I think sometimes we have what I would call a slightly colored, afflicted compassion, and a little unwise compassion. And often what I find interesting in this time is to look at the subtext. What is really underneath? What is behind this compassion? Because of course, you might have a feeling that compassion is not just a feeling. There can be so many other things around it. And I think often one of the things that occur is what I would call self-interest. You have what I would call self-interest compassion, that actually you are compassionate to somebody, but not so much because of them, but more because of you. Because it makes you feel good, or because you can get rid of something kind of feeling good about. This is what happened to me every autumn.
people trying to give me something in great compassion, and I really don't know what to do, and I don't want to insist it on somebody else. I think we often do that. But also, in a way, because I remember once I was in Korea, and in Korea you really have to be compassionate, and one of the things is that you have to share your food. You cannot eat on your own. This is very bad. Maybe now that they do it more because of modern life. But when I was there, it was very bad form. You don't eat on your own. This is very self-serious, not compassionate and all that. So here I was in a town and I was hungry. So I got some nuts. But then I could not eat these nuts by myself. As a Buddhist nun, I had to share them with somebody. So I kind of looked for a likely candidate of my compassionate action. And my victim was this little boy, Pastor, you know? 2 years old, Pastor. So I gave him some, and he found that because I was a nun, could not refuse. So he said, "Sit." And he started to eat them, and it was a disaster. They were stuck everywhere. And then I realized, I am not doing this for him. I am doing this for me. And this was a great lesson to me, to look, where does this compassion come from? Where does this action, which seems to look compassionate on the surface, where does it really come from? And in a way, what is this result going to be? So I would say, in a way, to me, in the most important in compassion is actually listening. Listening to what is it that is needed? What is it that is asked? Can I give it? Or is something asked? So in order to kind of really listen to oneself, to others, to the condition. And often we go to South Africa, and one day we had this Christmas for the children in the village, and I thought the headmaster was seemed really nice, and we thought, oh yes, we want to do something for the school because they're very poor there. And, you know, I said, you know, what do you need? My idea was, I saw the girls going to fetch water with the jerry cans, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice for them to have a water closer? But I asked, and he said, no, what we need is a photocopier. And they needed a photocopier because they don't have enough books for all of them. And then if they had a photocopier, then in a way, so many more children could benefit from it. And then at the same time, it could benefit the village, and then it could also benefit the other villages, and then it kind of has much more of a choice. So then he said, that's what I want, that's the thing. That's what you want, that's what we will provide. So you know, to listen, because we have ideas, but it's a little theoretical idea, sometimes ideological ideas. Also, another compassion that we might have, or we might encounter, is what I call barter, commercial compassion. I give you a little something, but I expect a big thing in return. You know, you kind of think, oh yes, here, this is for you, and then, but at the back of your mind you think, you know, you're going to get something in return. And you know, to be careful with that. You know, if we give something, we really give it. With no thought in the back, we just give it. And my teacher used to say that we give something with compassion, we give it as if we were giving a dirty mop. A dirty mop, a broom. You know, when you wash the floor? Because if you gave a dirty mop to somebody, you really would not expect anything. You know? You would be grateful that they took it. So he said, in the same way, when you give, no expectation. You trust you with an open heart. Because it's hard, because it's needed, and because you can do it. Also, I think what we have to be careful with compassion is what I would call theories, ideological compassion, where we, in a way, think that we know what is best for people. So we're going to save them. And often against their wishes, because they think we know the truth and they don't. And it will be much better for them. And then we want to show our compassion that way.
I remember when we lived in the community, we had a friend who was dying. I mean, he'd been dying for a long time, but then he finally was dying of cancer. And he really, and it was amazing, because he was told that he would die in 2 years. And he lived 15 years. I had never seen such will to live in somebody. He was amazing. He wanted to live. Even if he was a Buddhist, he wanted to live there to the last, didn't he? So he was very strong on life, and he wanted to live. And we had this other member of the community, and his favorite activity was to go to see the friend who was dying, and to say, "Isn't it wonderful that you are dying? You have so much opportunity to reflect on impermanence and this and that." And I generally used to know when he would go, so I would kind of point when he went, and as soon as he left the room, I would go into the room, because I would know, I know that my dying son would be fuming, would be so furious. "You do not want to die, you do not want to look into impermanence, you do not care." So I used to kind of, you know, talk to him, so he would kind of calm a little and kind of. But it was very interesting that sort of misreading of the situation. Or for myself, once I had a friend who had great difficulty, and so I said, "What can I do to help you?" She said, "Please, can you visit my mother? We were in a nursing home." And I said, "Sure, I can do this." And I said, "Same as with other guys." I thought, "Great. You know, we're going to talk about impermanence and, you know, emptiness and things like this, you know." So off I go, full of, you know, all kind of things we can talk about. And I get there. And she's hallucinating. She has a tendency to hallucinate and to see huge insects. So I talk to her and said, "Oh! Look!" And I said, "Because it's nothing." And so then, my task, once a week, was to do something very un-Buddhist. To distract her. To totally distract her from the present moment. And to take her to the past. To take her to joy in her past. So in order to do that, I had to know her. I had to ask her, "What is it you like? You know, what is your story?" So then I learned she liked cricket, and she liked making jam and roses. And when I could see that look in her eyes, I said, "Oh, what about that cricket match?" And then off she went. And then that was forgotten. And so in a way, to see, compassion is really about bringing that creative wisdom to let go of our ideas of what we think is better is best. We have to respond to the situation in the moment. And I think that's why, in a way, this awareness meditation is so useful in terms of compassion. And then we have expecting compassion. That, I mean, you want to be compassionate, but people must change. Because if you are compassionate and they're not going to change, what's the point? I mean, we are, you know, not only in a very capitalist society, compassion becomes capitalist too, you know? And I think it's interesting. Often, at least, they must say, "Thank you." And it must say. I mean, if they ask something and you give it, you just do it. And I had to learn. And his hobby, you know, that's, I mean, he has a job and everything, but his hobby is to be compassionate. Two private individuals, each on the street. So again, you can look for the truth, you know, like, you know, good candidate for his compassion. That's his hobby. So one day he's in a town, and you see the perfect candidate. So he stood there on the street without luck. I mean, perfect. So he said, "I am going to help this guy." So he goes to the guy who's really smelly and dirty and really kind of looks really bad. And he said, "You know, I'm going to help you." So I said, "Why not?" So, you know, he kind of clean him up, help him with the social security and everything. But the problem is that the beggar is also an addict, a drug addict. So it lasts a little while, and then he goes back to drug addiction. Then this man then kind of drops it, and then the guy goes back to the to his street at the bus stop. So the guy drops him and everything. He's still on the street. No, I'm not doing something. So he go back, find him again, and do the same thing. Brush him up, clean him up, and help him. And the guy go back to drug and to the street. And he abandons him again. He did that. So this bothers him. This really bothers him, you know. So, he decides, I'm going to go and help this guy, but I'm going to help him no matter what. No matter what he does, no matter what happens, I am going to be there for him. So go and find him and tell him that. No matter what happens, I am there for you. I believe in you, I am there for you. And that makes the difference. So the guy then really says, well, if you believe in me, maybe I should believe in myself too. I mean, then it really turned. And to me, it shows a difference to him expecting something, wanting something in a way, in his compassion. When he did not expect anything, but he was totally there, then something could change. Something could be different. Then there is pity and truly compassion. And he was very happy to be compassionate to little fluffy rabbits. Or to people who are really nice to us. Oh yes, 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 oh yes, you know, I will do anything for you. Possibly, possibly. This is difficulty. But we're not so ready to be compassionate to people who are really difficult. And we say, oh, but they're so difficult and it's so painful and they want so much, and ooh, and I get a funny feeling, and to me this is interesting, that in a way compassion is open to everybody, and I would say, especially to difficult people, and to see that difficult people have to live with themselves all the time. You only have to see them time to time, and be compassionate to them. But often people make it so difficult, they tell you an hour. It's only 30 minutes on the phone. It's only a visit. Once a week. And so in order to be careful of just having compassion when it is easy. Because we also have to be not, you know, sometimes we of course have to be careful. But I think we also have to open to compassion to people. We are not so easy, we are difficult, but it's not so kind of easy for us to do that. Also, we can look a little at what are the obstacles to us being compassionate. Personally, I would see two main ones. One is being busy. This is very interesting, being busy. What happens when we're busy? How long is it? We get into this monomind where, I must do this, I must do this. And we get really fixed. And if somebody is in pain, the spirit says, I don't have the time. I don't have the time, I must do this. I think that's what interests me about my teacher, Master Kudan. Once, at the end of a retreat, a car came. In those days, it was really special to have a car come to pick him up. He was going to do the talk. And everybody was kind of saying, Master, the car has arrived, you must go. And so they were kind of talking, you know, let's go, you know, this is, hurry. And then I just was passing by, and I said, oh, you know, please go around. And he stopped and said that, how is Stephen? Because Stephen was very ill with the cold. He said, how is Stephen? I said, well, he's not so well, he still has a bad cold. And the master said, oh, I have some orange juice. I'm going to get it for him. So you must tell everybody what himself to go and get the juice and to give it to me. And to me that was very impressive, that somebody could stop along this hurrying, along this movement, and say, no, I have the time to consider something else. I have the time to be compassionate. I will not be taken over, fixed by the business, by the hurriedness. And so for us to really look, what is it in a way that constricts us.
What is it that makes us?
Dunya, other. And all the thing is fear.
But in a way, this is a
one of the things is fear, that when you're afraid, actually it really closes you off to any time in anybody else. This is very, I think it's very important to say, the more we're afraid, and the way I would say generally the less, we will be compassionate. We're not, it's not necessary, but often that's what happens when you're afraid. And when I think of a writer I greatly admired, and he's called Carl Apert, and now he's died of an illness. So he wrote a book called Convicted in the Womb, which is basically about the sociological condition of the young black American in America in the ghettos. And through that book he also told his story. And he told his story of he was born in a very poor family, in a very poor neighborhood, and very early on he became very asocial. And he learned that, you know, you have to always be careful because somebody might attack you. And so he became very aggressive because he would be the aggressor, so nobody would kind of, you know, bother him. So, you know, he had no compassion, no love for anything, anyone in his heart. The only thing was protecting himself. And because of that, he went many times to jail, to juvenile, and then he was also a little in a regular jail. And in a way, and there too, he was known as a bad guy. You know, he made himself very good, very bad, I'm the bad guy, don't mess with me. So again, that's kind of, because he was so afraid as a protection. And what actually changed his life was the fact that he was put in solitary for 2 weeks. And in that room where he was, there was a little table, and there was one log which was shorter. So to make it equal, they put the work of Shakespeare. And so for these 2 weeks, he read the works of Shakespeare. Again and again and again. That's who they read. Only way that changed his life. Because it really changed his way of feeling. And after that, he totally changed his life. He went to university, and actually, that arose great compassion. And from that, he started to work with gangs and things like this. And to me, it was interesting, that movement. Because one would have thought, this guy is lost. He can't have no compassion in his heart. But the obstacle to the compassion was the fear. And as soon as he could see himself differently, that something else creative could be awakening him, then fear could grow, and compassion could arise instead. So in a way, in compassion, to see for ourselves, what is the obstacle to my compassion? Because I think many different people can have many different obstacles. And in a way to look, what is responsive, wise compassion? How can I respond skillfully? How can I listen? And I think, again, that can be to oneself, to one's family, it can be in many different ways. And in a way, each of us has to find one's way to be compassionate. Once I met I was in Korea doing some research on women and Buddhism, and I was sent to this big Lhasa complex, because there was a great Buddhist member, a great practitioner. And I would say generally you don't associate a Lhasa complex with a Buddhist man. You know, kind of generally the two don't seem to go together. But here I go, and there was an auditorium for theater and singing and swimming pools and language class and everything. There are like 100 activities. And I go to this nun, he's a nun who had done lots of meditation. She was one of the great nuns in Korea. And I said to her, but how come you're here? How come you're doing this? She's a little departure for what nuns do generally in Korea. And she said, well, the capital, Seoul, in this kind of new neighborhood, had created this leisure complex. And then they thought, who should we give it to who can take care of it in a positive way? So they said, maybe the Buddhists could have it. So they go to the main order, where generally most of them are monks, And they say, you know, when you destroy the complex, you know, you want to get charge of it. And the monk thought, who could do this well? Then they thought, of course, the nuns can preserve it. Well, I didn't need to be social and all that. Okay. And so then, you know, among the nuns, they all said, but who can do this? And then everybody said, well, you should be able to do it. So here she found herself at the head of this thing, which she had never thought of. And she said, yeah, it was great. Because she could see the benefit for the old people to go swimming, for people to meet, to learn things, to do. And she said, yeah, this is a good idea. Maybe we should have a leisure center in every town in Korea. And then I asked her, but what is your practice? How do you practice? And she said, well, I practice in my daily life because I'm not, you know, I don't have so much time to do, you know, sitting meditation. But whenever, you know, I am by myself, I try really to always, you know, bring the question, bring the awareness, everything. What is it? And I really try to meditate as I go about my life, how I meet people, what I do, how I do it. In a way, that, because before she just did formal practice, she did long retreats, but now she said she had to do the meditation in the daily life, how she encounters the people, organize the activities. So, in a way, I think there are many different types of creative wise compassion. I think all of us, in our own circumstances, have to look, have to explore, how can I be wise and compassionate in my life? What does it mean? But also to see that we also have our limitations. That sometimes we are asked something we cannot provide, we cannot give. Also, in a way, we have to accept that. Also, at times, the only thing we are asked to do is just to do that. Because I think also in compassion we are sometimes too active. We want things to change. We want the person to be better. But the person needs time. I have a friend who, when I was closer, but now whenever I see her, I spend, you know, some time with her. And at the beginning I had all kind of ideas to help her, because she used to tell me all her problems. And so I would say, what about this and what about that? But quickly I realized she did not want any of my good ideas. The only thing she wanted was for me to listen to her and to love her. That's all she requires from me. That I recognize that she exists, that I recognize that she's a human being, that I listen to her, that I'm interested in what she has to say. And this is all she needs. And to know that I think of her, I know her, that's all she needs. So for us to look about compassion in many different ways, you can do it in a very active way, but sometimes the only thing you have to do is actually to be there for the other person. And so, that's what I wanted to say today. Any questions or comments? Yes? In a way, for him, in a way, that he thought, in general, a lot of people are very afraid of death and of dying. And so he seems to feel that he did not know how he was going to be. Was he going to be afraid? Was he going to lose it? Was he going to be... He had no idea. I mean, he presumed that he had the good days to be afraid. But he was saying, you know, I need to be aware, I need to be stable, I need to be present, so that when it comes, I won't be overwhelmed, I won't be disturbed, I won't be caught, but I will be able to be with it in a stable, clear, awakened manner, in a way. To me, that's what he seems to say, so that I will be present to it, I will engage with it in a creative way. That's the way I heard it. So not that, you know, we have to always be sitting in meditation just in case we're going to die. But that, in a way, if we lose ourselves, if we lose ourselves in greed, hatred and delusion, then we won't be really having the state of mind which could possibly help us at such a time. I think that's what you were saying.
I think more general.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good start. I think, in a way, seeing with fear is to see what happens, what is the mechanism. And I think often, one of the things we do, we are afraid in the future. I mean, if somebody is in front of you with a gun, this is very different. Now, with a gun, if you're afraid, this is totally normal, survival mechanism, then I would say the best thing you can do there is to be stable, to be open, and to be creative. What can I do in this situation? But if we talk of fear, which is what I think, possibly not in Israel, Israel is a little different. There's more things happening, and I'm sure that when you were during the war recently, if you were in Galilee, you were a little afraid because of all the noise and you didn't know where the thing was going to fall. So it's a little more present, but outside of those circumstances, which where I would say the only thing that you can do is have stability, openness, and creativity in this situation, it seems to me. But you see, often that fear is in the future. That, you know, we're afraid of something happening. And that's what I would say one of the ways to really often deal with the fear is to come back to the present. Is there something really happening in this moment? Is there really something dangerous in this moment? Because when I was in Korea, I used to be very afraid at night because it was very dark there. And I was afraid of the dark, so I would go out to the toilet, and the moment before I put the light on, my heart would beat so fast, and I would imagine there is a guy, he's coming to get me with a knife, and I was like this. And then one, sometimes we do this all night shift, so I thought, I'm not going to survive, I'm going to be kind of, you know, trembling all night. So I went to my sister and I said, what should I do? I'm afraid of night. He said, go back to the question. And I thought, oh, the question is like a magic. Something is going to protect me from the bad guy out there. So that's what I did. Whenever the feeling would arise, I would think, what is it? And then I saw it was not a magic wand. But what is it brought me down to this moment. And in this moment, I was in the middle of nowhere in Korea. Who would know to come and get me anyway? And in a way, to me this is the thing, to look in the moment, is there something frightening or not? Is there a reason to be frightened? And also, that's why I was talking about dealing with the feeling. How can I deal with my feeling without being disturbed by them? So when we are fear, I mean, sometimes I'm afraid, maybe if I meet somebody or if somebody speaks to me in a certain way, I can say, but if I bring that stability and openness, then I am not disturbed by it. I'm aware, I'm afraid, I'm a little uncomfortable, I don't know what's going to happen, but I can deal with it. I am not overwhelmed with it. So that's also what happened with fear. We overwhelm and we really exaggerate and we proliferate. And to see what is really frightening here. Is there something frightening? Is there something frightening? Do something about it. This is also the thing. You know, to say, fear, 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 and the guy beats you up. No, no, you kind of run. Or do whatever is supposed to be required. But to in a way, look, what is it that makes you afraid? And when I'm afraid, how do I feel? What happens? What do I tell myself? What are the conditions? So personally, I would engage with it. Try to engage with it in many different ways. The Buddha, in a way, taught the loving kindness as an antidote to fear. That is an interesting. Because when you cultivate loving kindness, actually, it is an antidote to fear.
You mentioned that you translated, I think you said the 58th.
What do you say about Christian?
Where is this translation, and also could you say a little bit more?
I get confused with your having a different return. On the last morning, we brought some of our books just for you to look at, because we did not bring them to sell, but we brought them just for you to see, and so you will see various books, and one of them will be this book, which is called The Path of Compassion, and it is my translation of the Bodhisattva precepts with an introduction to explain the precepts in the Buddhist tradition.
From Korean?
Yeah, Korean and Chinese, and it's in English. And to me this text is very interesting, because it really influences the way people do things in the monastery in Korea. Quite different from the ordinary people. You can really see that it really kind of became organic in the life of the monastery and the nunnery. It's very interesting. But at the same time, it's a text which you, like any religious text, you have to read at different levels. You have a dogmatic level. I mean, some of the stuff which it said is not very nice. It's, for example, it says that, you know, the heterodox are no better than stones. So, I mean, it kind of, you know, it's very much against, you know, kind of the one who are not of that type of the people who wrote the book, or wrote the precept. So, at any text, it seems to me what is interesting, any text generally will be a little dogmatic, saying we are better than. So there's always a part of any religious text. Then another part of it is political. You kind of really see that at that time something was going on. And so you can see that there is kind of a few precepts who are kind of more able to deal with the political situation in terms of the king and various things going on. And then half of the precepts then are really about compassion. And then you have some really interesting things, because you have the title, that, you know, do not steal or whatever it is, and then you have an explanation. And the explanation is very interesting. Now, for example, with do not steal, it says, do not do it yourself, do not do it in a roundabout way, do not have somebody else do it for you, do not create the condition for it to happen. So it really looks that not just because it's easy for us to say, oh, I don't steal, but do you do something which might lead to that? Same with stealing. You might not do it yourself, but you create the conditions so that it can happen. So it's really, to me, it's kind of like a reflection often on what do we do and how do we do it? What is going on? So really looking. Very interesting. There is a wonderful one which is about not being angry. And in not being angry, because it goes against compassion and it helps people, they say, do not hurt your slave, and do not beat an inanimate object. And this was in the 4th century in China. So basically we're saying that if you have a problem with a table, or with a cart, don't kick it. And we're not tense much. What do you do if your computer doesn't work? Or your car doesn't work? And they were already doing it in China 1,500 years ago. And then what, and in terms of do not, you know, insult or do bad things to yourself, to me, I mean, we don't have slaves, we don't have servants. No servant, it's not slave, it's servant. But what we have is the service industry. And I don't know if in Israel, possibly you don't have people selling you a double glazed window over the phone, you know, wanting to sell you all kind of things. Maybe you don't do that here.
You do.
So what do you say after the service time? No, thank you. Or something else.
And you know, when you're in the supermarket or in the post office, what do? How we kind? To me, this is part of the practice. Is when I'm in the queue in the supermarket, you know, to be kind to the lady or to the man at the counter or at the post office. That is part of that. So this is a text. There is all kind of things in it. Some weird, some very inspiring, and some kind of cultural too. Okay. I think that compassion, in a way, again, is like a spectrum. Sometimes you go more toward others, because you have the space and everything works that way. Sometimes you have to go more toward yourself, because that's the condition, and sometimes you are in the middle, both equal. I remember, I mean, generally I'm very kind of present to people and very happy to help them, but for 2 years, I was quite ill. I had some problems physically, and I would get in really great pain. And the thing is that because I'm generally kind and compassionate, because I was in pain, everybody wanted to be compassionate to me. And so they wanted to come and visit me and all that. I did not want to see anybody, because so painful. I just could like just be there and wait, you know. And it was very interesting for me, the thing that, in a way, they wanted to be compassionate, and I did not give them much time to do that. Because I could not, I really just could be with myself. And to me, it was a great lesson, though. You see that sometimes we can grasp, have compassion to ourselves, because in that moment, we can't do anything else. But it doesn't mean that at another moment, we can be totally wrong of somebody else. It's a way to kind of see a little according to condition, and in that way not force ourselves when we can really cannot do it, when we don't have the energy, we don't have the physical ability or whatever. And also it's true that you were talking about rejoicing. Mudita is another quality to cultivate, which is to rejoice in your happiness and to rejoice in the happiness of others. And I think this is also quite actually tied to compassion. Because one thing we tend to do, which is a big strength, somebody comes to you with a wonderful news, something wonderful is happening to them, and very quickly you kind of, oh, but what about this? And what about that? And by the end, they kind of, hey, we're just in this place. And, you know, it can be wonderful. You know, if somebody is really happy with something, can we really be happy with them? Because in a way, it will increase our happiness and their happiness. But to me, this is also part of mudita, is rejoicing that it is very important, appreciating what is good. But also it's kind of to be compassionate when somebody brings the happiness to us. There was something here and then there, and then we have to stop. Yeah. To know it. The first thing with anger is to know it fully in the whole body and mind complex. Look, when you're angry, generally you are in the story of it. It depends also what you're angry about. One has to be careful, you know. It's different to be angry against poverty, to be angry because you come, something is not working, or whatever. But my first thing would be to say, know it fully. That means know the suffering fully. Know it fully, but know it not just as the story in your head, as in your whole body and mind. See what is going on. Because it's a whole body and mind, heart experience. So to see what it does to the body, when it's really shaking, when it is like this. Also that you here, it's kind of there's things going on here. And also we are telling something to ourselves. And I think in a way with the bodily sensation, with the feeling, I would say to try to be present to them. But with the story in the mind, to try to question it. What am I telling myself? Is this totally true? Because one of the things we do when we're angry, we generalize very fast.
all the time. And we do a lot in anger of whatever we call negative reinterpreting. It's very interesting how something is going on, there is a problem, but in order to feel justified to be so angry about that, then we have to be so baggage what we bring into the situation, which personally I think generally doesn't help at all. And 2 months ago, you did that. And I mean, you. When I think what is important is in the moment, what is really going on? Why am I angry? Because sometimes that things, often what happens is that something happens. Okay. Next. Okay. And then finally, poof. So in a way, to try to be aware, if you can, at the beginning of the, because generally there is little, you know, something kind of, so in order to see the whole processes, to become interested, I would say to become interested in it, this is meditating on it. Oh, I'm not talking, no, but I'm not, yeah, oh, I do it all the time. I mean, I don't sit, I never watch anger in meditation, sitting, never. You know, I mean, when I sit, I don't have anger. I mean, what's the point? It's not there. No point to bring it here. Yeah. Okay, I'll give an example. Two examples. Quick. One day, I was taking care of some people. I used to see them regularly. And one day, one of them decided, I am not going to see you today. And for 30 minutes, he started to attack me. Verbally, not physically, verbally. So we were in a place, and I was through, and he was there, and he was very clever. I never seen something done so well. I mean, generally, people are not so angry with me, so it's their opportunity to see how it is done. So, I mean, he was kind of like a cold anger. Really, he was very clever. But I couldn't see anything I could do with this. I couldn't do anything with it. What he said had nothing to anything I had done. I could not identify with it at all. So I just stood there. I was not very present, but I stood there, and I just was with the stability and openness. And then when he finished, I said, "Oh, okay, if you don't want to see me, right? Fine." And then later, I saw him. I mean, anyway. But there was a time somebody did this in a different context. I was at a meeting. The guy was a little drunk. And he went on at me, for 20 minutes. He was very uncomfortable. And relatively painful. And so, you know, you're always organizers and and it was very unpleasant, of course. I did not like it at all. But he had a little of a point. I like to organize. So I didn't like it. But again, I just listened to it. And then later I thought, yes, you know, I can try to be more careful there. And at the same time, I was a little more careful with him because he didn't know what he would do next. But not kind of cutting him off. So, you see, you can just be sometimes, and sometimes I'm angry myself. 2 years ago, I was really, I mean, I don't lose it anymore. But 2 years ago, something happened. And I lost it a little. I was very frustrated because the person said things which I thought was really not true. So finally, I lost it. Anyway. And so I was a little shocked for 10 minutes. And it was in a very Buddhist context, so it was very looked down upon. You know, it passed. And, you know, and what was in, you know, as soon as I stopped it, I realized, yeah, it was not that useful in terms of what I said was not constructive and did not help the situation, but did not make it worse either. It was pretty worse already, so it was okay. But, and at the same time, I thought, yeah, it's okay, that's what happened.
Because, you know, it was so frustrating that I could not do anything else at that moment. And then later I wrote an email to the person, excusing myself but not moving from what I thought was my bottom line. And voila! So the guy kind of accepted my excuse and at the same time could see my point. So it's a trick too. I mean, but what I mean is to be present to it. That's what I mean in the meditation. And today, this is what, you know, we train here so that in daily life we can do this. Huh? In the meditation. Yeah, but this is, that's why, again, I think it's better to train when it is not happening. And when you kind of, you know, you do it here when it's easy to do. And then you do it when it's more difficult to do. And then you can do it when it's very difficult to do. So it's kind of gradual. That's the way I would look at it. But generally, it's better to start when it's easy. Because if you start when it's, you know, you are, you know, big one, then I think, you know, this is, that's what happened, this is life. And then you see it at the end. Of course.
I think I heard you say that loving kindness could be an antidote to fear.
Okay, this is a story, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the Buddha, and you have these monks who were in the forest meditating, and they're very afraid, especially at night, they're afraid, you know, with the noise and the tigers, and they're very frightened that something would happen to them, and they're sitting in meditation. So they come to the Buddha and they say, what should we do? And the Buddha said, do loving kindness. May I be happy, may I be at peace, may I be free from suffering, may you be happy, may you be at peace, may you be free from suffering. Because the way it works, I think it's back to the fear of what is not, when there is no danger. I mean, if you are in the middle of a very, if you are in a dangerous place, I would not say it should work, because of course, there is danger, you have to do something. But this is, so when we are afraid of something that is not there, when we are afraid in the future, or we are afraid of, because of images. I think often people are really afraid sometimes of people when actually the people have never done anything to them. So often we are very much afraid in the abstract. And I think by cultivating loving kindness, you say the world is a benign place. That's the thing that you kind of, in a way, inclining your mind toward believing that, in general, most people are relatively benign. I know in Israel it's a little more tricky, possibly, because of various conditions, again. But, again, you have to see if it's true or not. I mean, again, you have to see. That's, I think, the way the Buddha meant it, to see the world as a more benign place, to open more to the humanity of most people most of the time. Is that what you think? So please, one can do it.
Yes.
How does that go for fear of dying? Now that I think is a little different. But I think it meant more in terms of fear of things.
Yeah,
fear of dying. Then I think we do not, I don't think, you know, I think with fear of dying, I think it would work better to do equanimity. The accept things as they are, I think it would work better with fear of dying things than possibly loving kindness. But one has to try this thing and see what works. The fear of dying, I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, you have a meditation on death. And Stephen has practiced it a lot. And he said it is very interesting thing to do. When you kind of reflect on that, the first thing you reflect that death is certain, you kind of reflect on the fact that death will happen,
exactly. Let me reflect on the fact that the death, the moment of death is uncertain. You never know when you're going to die. And you reflect on this in many different ways. And then you ask yourself, since it is so, that death is certain, but the time of death uncertain, what is the most important thing for me to do now? And that's also a meditation which possibly helps. So, I think we should stop now, so we have 15 minutes on walking meditation.